great writers. Like, Plato was a great writer, obviously. Yeah, like, there's no question he was a literary genius as well as a philosophical genius. But it's hard to say with Aristotle if he was a great writer, because we have his lecture notes, which are not the easiest thing to read, and some of them, like the Metaphysics, are extremely challenging. Kant was not, like, people try to defend Kant a little bit with, like, oh, well, the subject matter is so hard that it's, like, he's doing his best. But it's, like, he's not, he's basically like, I'm going to write the way I'm going to write. And if you're smart enough to get it, you can get it. Otherwise, you're too dumb.
Think about what Descartes did when he wrote the Meditations. He wrote it in Latin so that it wouldn't be accessible to a non-Latin speaking audience, right? And he wrote his popular works in French. So, like, he literally disambiguated between stuff that he wanted to be understandable to the masses and stuff that he only wanted to be understandable to the to the lettered world at the time, right?
So I think, yeah, but getting back to it, it's like, I think now there's a counterpoint to my point, though, which is basically, look, there are some great accessible either secondary literature or philosophical novels or whatever that allow people to get some really good grasps on philosophical ideas while keeping the reading engaging and interesting and relatively accessible. However, there is a counterpoint or the other side of this, which is there is now a whole industry of what I would call, like, kind of BS self-help philosophy books. Right? Like Sophie's World has been great so far because it really is a novelization of, you know, the history of Western philosophy by Bertrand Russell, right? Which again has its issues, but, like, ultimately it gives you a good grasp. You're going to finish Sophie's World and have a good generalized understanding of the history of Western philosophy, right? But there is also all sorts of books that take particular, this is particularly true with Stoicism, as you and I both know, like, probably more than anything else, but Nietzsche as well, you see it a bit with Epicureanism, of turning those sorts of schools of thought more or less into self-help kind of inspirational garbage books, which are not actually good starting points.
Yeah, I mean, so to bring this back to the episode that we did with Sebastian a little bit, because, I mean, this is a book that you had sort of opted to include into it, so it's relevant, obviously. But in some of the preparation that we were doing, one of the things that we were preparing to discuss were potentially books that we found overrated, right? And I kind of had a hard time picking a particularly overrated book, because for me, an overrated book is not one that is necessarily bad. It just gets undue attention, and that undue attention distorts a person's ability to actually, like, read it. And I thought about it for a while, and it actually was a sort of Stoicist, or, you know, we use this term pejoratively, the Broicist movement. It was Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, just because, I mean, every time I go to the bookstore, I mean, bookshelves in bookstores don't have very many shelves dedicated to philosophy, but at least one full shelf is just housing copies of the Meditations, right? The thing sells very well.
Looking at my friends' libraries who don't have much interest in philosophy or whatever, I almost always find the Meditations in there. Like, it's almost always in there. And I think it's exactly because it is so kind of overrated. It's this, like, ancient self-help thing. It's also, like, he was one of the five great emperors of Rome, so it's, like, this super interesting, like, backstory to it and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, like, It's a work of Stoic philosophy. Like, it's fine. Like,
yeah, whatever. It's fine. I mean, you know, it has some interesting kind of ideas. It has a fragment of Heraclitus, so it's really useful for that. But I think, like, in particular, what makes it, yeah, well, that's the thing, is it contains a fragment, so we get that, and that's worth that's worth the whole pile, right? But in any case, yeah, I think what makes it in particular like overrated and sort of like, you know, an industry book is that it's read exactly like that as a self-help book that the and there's another thing about quoting it as well that I might get into if I remember. But I mean, stoicism is not just like telling yourself things to cope through reality, right? Like that's just one. That's not even all of the ethical component. I mean, Stoicism had three branches. It had logic, physics, and then the ethics. But you don't get the ethics unless you have the logic and the physics, right? So, I mean, as like a, I don't want to say, like, as a, I guess a studied philosophy student who's like looked into the, you know, the physics and the logic of Stoicism, I have a very hard time understanding how to even actually like practice the ethics without understanding like the physical backdrop upon which you, you know, root your ethics, because your Stoic ethics is so cosmopolitan, it's so metaphysical that like you could, how would you know that like the advice that you're going to tell yourself through the meditations actually like works unless you see the big picture within which these practices are situated, right? Otherwise, you're just going off of impressions. You're kind of just like, you're just vibing your way through self-help, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a big, like a good point is a lot of times like these more self-helpy side of like the philosophy that we see today, published today, takes like Sophie's World, for example, again, is ultimately just a teaching tool to introduce basic ideas through the history of philosophy, right? It's not trying to induce you to like, oh, well, if you practice Stoicism or if you practice, you know, becoming the Ubermensch or whatever, you know, you'll do, you know, whatever you're going to do, right? You're going to take over the world or whatever. But these other works, they have a different goal. They have a different telos, obviously, which is, you know, they're selling you on bettering yourself, rather than like, you know, just learning and knowledge for the sake of itself, for the sake of its own good. And so what they do is they chop down and, you know, kind of reformat particularly stuff like Stoicism into a very digestible self-help, you know, shake that you can easily drink down. But as you're saying, you know, they tend to skip over the like boring stuff that people would like struggle with to try, like, you know, for example, like trying to understand Stoic metaphysics or whatever, right? Like you know, like as you said, the Stoics had a pretty complex you know kind of post-Platonist, you know, view of the universe of their own, which is directly related to their ethical systems. But that kind of stuff basically always gets cut because it's, you know, hard to understand, and it's not applicable as a product.
Yeah, so that's the main thing I was going to say. Like, there's almost this divorce between theory and practice that in Stoicism, in like actually practice Stoicism, is a happy marriage, right? Like, if you don't understand the like kind of the semi-deterministic universe that the Stoics live in, you're not going to understand why the practices actually work, right? Like, and there's also just like physical theories in Stoicism too. Like, this is, it's a school coming from an age where science and philosophy were not seen as separate, right? Like, they had a theory about the cyclical rebirth and destruction of the universe that tried to explain why some moments feel more intense than others, right? And that grounds the practice of trying to attend to a moment, right? It's not just that when you it's not just that like, oh, understanding the background is just like neat information, you know? No, like, if you're being a Stoic and you want to attend carefully to a moment and apply your attention, which is like basically, you know, being reductive, but like that's one of the basic kind of moves you can make as a Stoic, is to direct your attention to the proper object. If you don't understand the theory of ekpyrosis, you don't understand why it's possible to do that.
Yeah, you're just instructed to do it, right? Like, you're given some very thin, veiled reasoning, or effectively just told, because, and oftentimes it's leaning on, oh, well, this is what Marcus did, right? Like,
yeah,
know, he's the guy.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean when I say you're kind of just like vibing your way through it. This is the other kind of like connection to, in particular, like that term broicism. It's like a very masculine model of self-help. And you elect these kind of, you know, an emperor sage, Marcus Aurelius. He's, you know, Aristotle argues that like you need an exemplar and that's good. If you don't understand the theory behind like why he did that, and not only that, that like Marcus Aurelius did care about that stuff, well, you're failing to emulate a very important part of his character.
Marcus Aurelius explicitly wanted his journals, which have become the Meditations, destroyed upon his death, right? Like they were actually personal work. And so, I mean, like, it's an odd thing in a way to then repurpose that in all sorts of different ways. But he never wanted them published.
That's an interesting thing that I've thought about a bit too, just because like, because I don't know if listeners know this, but I've kept a diary for, I think, since a couple of weeks ago. It's now like 15 years old. So I go through the practice of seeing or of doing what like Marcus Aurelius would do. And I've thought about that a little bit too, about like, well, these are texts that I'm not actually like the audience for. I think when the journal or when his when these writings, the Meditations, were originally found out, they were actually titled "To Myself" or "To Himself" or something like that. They explicitly make that function of his writings explicit, right? So there's one way of reading the Meditations where it's like you take the content on its face, but then there's another reading where you don't necessarily take the content on its face, because you're not party to that conversation, to that dialogue. But there is something that you can get out of it, which is the practice of writing to yourself per se. And you can learn what that looks like. And then you can go and do that yourself. And then that's kind of the value of it. It's a little bit intrusive in that you're reading his journals, and he didn't intend them to be read. I wouldn't like people to, you know, read my diary. I guess there is something to be said for you have to learn how to do this, right? And one way of doing that is looking at other people's journals that maybe they publish or something like that. But that's, yeah, I've thought about that too, just because I do have a text that is to myself as well. So I was going to bring up Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. Now, obviously, Hannah Arendt's The Life of the Mind is far more foundational, so it's the more appropriate pick. The Philosophical Investigations have also really shaped how I practice and do philosophy. I am still kind of reading it and getting it under my skin and learning how to do what it does. And that's the other thing too, right? I mean, Wittgenstein said that after him, it was possible, or it would no longer be possible for us to have great philosophers, but now we could have skilled philosophers. So it's not like I can gauge whether I have like imbibed that text, whether, you know, based on like some image or majesty of myself as like a philosopher kind of, you know. But the point is, like, can you actually do what Wittgenstein could do? And in some instances, I've been able to emulate what he can do, but I still, you know, there's still cases where I struggle to be able to sort of coax language games for the purpose of comparison, to dissolve problems and stuff like that. He makes things very clear cut in that way, but it's a text that I still feel like I'm training in. So I'm, in a certain way, I'm glad I got to talk about one book over the other. But that is one book that I was going to discuss, was the Philosophical Investigations.
I was actually surprised that you didn't bring up the Philosophical Investigations in your, you know, in your options or in your trio.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense.
So the trio that we were going to bring up were a foundational text, so a text that has like informed how we do what we do. The second one was a contrarian pick, so a kind of maybe out of pocket pick, something that readers wouldn't expect for us to be influenced by. And then the third was a recommendation. I mean, I don't, I think I could recommend, I recommended Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. I hedged on it because it's a little difficult. I think Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations is more difficult than that, but I would still recommend it as well, even if it is difficult. But there's also, again, there's also secondary literature, which has helped me a lot to understand it. Finch's book, it's not particularly easily acquired, but it's good. Peter Hacker's Beginner's Guide is also really great. It has some dialogues that are really good at getting you kind of into the flow of doing what Wittgenstein did. But yeah, I mean, the Philosophical Investigations are pretty foundational for me as far as like how to, like, I know that it's a book that it's like a toolkit. It teaches you how to use particular tools. And I said that I'm still learning how to use that, but even kind of approaching philosophy from that angle in itself is a significant shift. And in that regard, I would say that that has 100% gotten under my skin of like treating, you know, he says the philosopher treats a problem, or he says a philosopher treats a question like an illness. And it's not that he treats a question like an illness, but he treats questions like illnesses, right? So it's not that questions are to be accepted on face value. Questions are symptomatic of things, right? And it's our job to treat them, to sort of listen to what the problem is. Don't just take the problem, don't take the question at face value. Really try and figure out what the problem is and treat it. And in that regard, I've very much so become like, that's definitely been a foundational moment for me as well. That's also one of the contributions I think that reading psychoanalytic literature has put into me, is like, that's another way of treating questions and problems and not taking things at face value. Asking, you know, what else, you know, when a person says, I was talking with a professor and he gave the example, you know, someone says they can't go to their wedding, and then you ask why, and they say, because I'm afraid of spiders, and everyone's afraid of spiders. It's like, well, no, something else is going on here. You know, you get to be, when you do Wittgensteinian kind of Freudian psychoanalysis, you get to be suspicious, and that's a lot of fun.
It does remind me a little bit of Wittgenstein's contemporary Heidegger, who we also bring up all the time, in his sense of, you know, noting that if, you know, if you're asking a philosophical question, in some sense, you already must have, like, within the question already beckons the answer. The answer to that question is already, in some sense, contained, or at least we have some idea of what it might be, right? Because otherwise, it's going to be nonsensical, right? So if you ask, like, again, like, why aren't you going to your wedding? And someone says, because I'm afraid of spiders, or, oh, well, because the xenons might show up from planet Uthu or whatever. You're like, that doesn't make sense, right? Like, within a sensical world and a sensical world of language, if you ask someone, why aren't you going to your wedding? There's going to be answers. There could be a plethora of answers, but they're going to be answers that make sense, right? They're going to be sensical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing too. Like, so this is one of the great things about that Peter Hacker mentions in making the comparison between psychoanalysis and philosophical investigation, is that there are, you know, there's similarities. The philosopher treats a question like an illness, but there are also dissimilarities, right? Like in psychoanalysis, what Freud was aiming to do was to show that the apparently nonsensical stuff that comes up in free association actually makes sense, right? There's some kind of underlying structure or, you know, dream logic to it. That's why we do dream work in psychoanalysis. But Wittgenstein's task was actually quite the opposite. His task was to take nonsense problems and make latent nonsense patent nonsense. Like the person who is actually bothered by philosophical problems should be brought to a point where they realize that the question doesn't even make sense to ask. Like, what is the relation of body to mind, right? Okay, well, when you actually do the philosophical investigation to dissolve the problem, it's not like some kind of underlying structure gets revealed that makes sense of the question. Now you can ask that question and go on to keep asking questions. No, the whole enterprise doesn't make sense, right? We're going to knock down a house of cards, Wittgenstein says. And in that regard, I think Heidegger, in a way, is right, because the question kind of beckons to itself, but is also wrong, because Heidegger is saying that the question contains its own sense. Wittgenstein would say that the question contains its own nonsense, and it's just the job to realize that the question is completely meaningless. Like, you can't, like, I'm sorry, you can't ask this question. You're doing it, but you can't do it, and we're going to show you you can't.
I wanted to bring up one of my other picks as well, which was Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. It's a work that we've talked about a couple times on the show, as you and I have both become more and more interested in media theory, and we've done it. I think quite a while ago we did a full episode on it. You know, when I for the show with Expert Bookshelf, I actually reread the first section. You know, I should say again, this book was written in the 1980s and is related to public discourse and the effects of television as a medium of knowledge and media and stuff like that. The first section is really the theory. The second section is examples. For any listeners out there, you're like, please read the second section. I have in the past, but I only read the first section for this because it's all the theory part, and the examples are quite dated because they're relating to, like, you know All in the Family and 1980s newscasters and stuff like that. But the theory holds very well for our modern, obviously for our modern social media, AI kind of era. And I think it's incredibly prescient because, you know, I think for our listeners out there and for anyone kind of just existing through today's world, there's all sorts of stuff going on. There's things happening. There's big events and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's more and more fragmented. It's turned into little bits. You know, you get little bits of information constantly about, you know, big events like, you know, as we're currently talking, recording this episode, there's a war with Iran and, you know, all these sorts of things. And there's currently a president who's, you know, getting on social media and basically saying that he's going to genocide a whole nation if they don't listen to him properly and all this kind of stuff. And all these things, I think Postman lays out, you know, can be understood through the lens of the actual technology that's being used to make them available to the consumer or to the user, right? Like Trump's crazy tirades never would have happened in, you know, 1895, right? Or whatever, right? And I think as well that it really goes in depth on the fact of, you know, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about, like, the medium and the metaphor. Like, Neil Postman was a student, obviously, of Marshall McLuhan, who we've talked about in the show, who is another great media theorist and a very important Canadian philosopher. So shout out there for our Canadian content. But he kind of takes it a step further, which I really like, whereas, you know, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. So basically, you know, whatever medium you're consuming or, you know, you're getting information through, whether it's a book or radio or a TV or whatever, smoke signals or whatever, it's going to form the content that's being presented. But Postman goes on further and basically says, especially in our hyper-technological media-driven world, the medium is the metaphor. And the metaphor is the metaphor of society. It's the metaphor of reality, right? Like, it's the way that you wake up every day and have as Heidegger might say, like an always already sort of thrown understanding of what the world is or what it is not, right? And Postman is kind of saying that, you know, that our mediums, our present media especially, is so powerful that it directly shapes our natural relationship to how we see ourselves, each other, our community in the whole world, not specifically even just pieces of content, you know, through social media or whatever, but literally how we understand what, you know, it means to be a human being or to be alive or to operate or to communicate all these things are so thoroughly vented through present media that they're the primary constructors of, you know, our current world, right? And that might sound strange, but then I ask people to look around and, you know, see that literally everybody has a smartphone, almost everybody uses social media, almost everybody gets content the same way. And I also think back to, you know, a few years ago, I spent a year traveling through Ethiopia, which was very interesting. But one of the things that I learned on my trip was, even in Ethiopia, most people had smartphones. They were usually Chinese ones or whatever. But they all came pre-downloaded with Facebook. And Facebook was effectively the only internet that people used. It wasn't even just like the regular internet or Google or whatever. They just used Facebook for everything. For communication, for banking, for blah, 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 for, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? It's for news. And so if Facebook is your whole community's whole conduit of public discourse and economic relationships and all this kind of stuff, well, then that's going to have an enormous influence on the kind of world that you live in, the kind of community that you live in, right? Like, it's, you live in a Facebook world, effectively.
You have one service, and that one service is going to prefigure the possibilities of communication through it, right?
And you know, we're living in it too. And, you know, it makes me think a little bit of another book that I was almost going to pick, but I decided not to, which I feel like you are going to guess what this is, but is Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative David Chalmers, but that's Mark Fisher, right? Where, you know, you become so immersed in a technological or a society that you can't even realize that you're immersed in it. You can't imagine being outside of it.
No, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Neil Postman in the episode in two. I thought it was a really good recommendation, a really prescient recommendation. And in particular, I mean, it's going to reach an audience of podcast listeners, so it's going to be relevant to them, right? I mean, they're getting this information through the very medium they should be looking at critically, right?
Yeah, and the other great thing about Postman, going back to kind of my points earlier, is while it's not like the lightest read ever, it is quite accessible, right? Like, it's definitely more accessible than, say, Marshall McLuhan or whoever. I love some of McLuhan's work. I own a few of his works, but they're very weird, full of all sorts of cryptic messaging, right? Like the eye, you know, the light bulb is the extension of the eye and all that kind of stuff, right? Like, it's Postman is most certainly writing for a popular audience, and it shows in the work. And so I encourage, you know, especially in our current media landscape, for readers to go and give it a look. Yeah, but I think regardless, it was a very important work of media theory, and I really recommend anyone to read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. Even though it is already 40 years old, it's probably better suited to today than it was 40 years ago. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we hope that you'll join us next week.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.